It was 200 episodes ago that I had my famous Michael Jackson rant on episode 75 of The Sound Off. If you can believe it, it's been 200 episodes since then. So I figured I'd play a little MJ here at the beginning of the show this week. That ought to make Webmaster Mike very happy. This is episode 275 of the Solomonster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com and Stitcher Radio. It is Sunday, May 26, 2013. I am the Solomonster. You can go back in the archives, by the way, and actually listen to episode 75. It is up. If you go to thesolomonster.com, from June 2010, I think that was the one-year anniversary, I reposted the entire episode. So if you go on there and search, you can stream it, you can download it. I've always been amazed at the reaction that show has gotten. Still very popular, so you can go back and check that out. Also, check out my latest LayfieldReport.com column on why Daniel Bryan is WWE's next big breakout star. And that may sound a little funny, given that Bryan has been with the company now for over 3 years. How could he be the next big breakout star? He's already been a world heavyweight champion. But the time has come for Daniel Bryan to break off on his own yet again. It looks as though Team Hell No is not long for this world. They are due a rematch against The Shield for the tag team titles. Perhaps they'll get that at the Payback pay-per-view next month. But after that, Daniel Bryan should, in fact, break out on his own and move on to either a world championship feud with Dolph Ziggler or, perhaps, even a WWE championship feud with John Cena, which is something we've never seen before. I mean, they've had a few matches on Raw, maybe two or three matches over the last few years, but never any sort of meaningful feud, never any pay-per-view singles matches against each other. And as I mentioned in the column, you know, Bryan, even though he's been relegated to really just tag team wrestling for the most part over the last several months, the fans are into him as much now as they've ever been before. You watch him in those Shield six-man tag matches, when he gets tagged in and Bryan is a house of fire in the ring, the fans are 100% into everything he does in there. It's not just the yes chance and the no chance. He's just got them in the palm of his hand, and it's interesting to me that he's been able to maintain that even though he's been positioned essentially as a mid-card tag team guy over the last 8 months. I think that says a lot, that he's been able to maintain that sort of popularity, and he may not be the biggest guy on the roster, but he never looks out of place, whether he's in there with somebody like Ryback or The Big Show or somebody more along his size like a Ziggler or CM Punk. People take him seriously. They buy into him. He's obviously got a lot of charisma, a lot of personality. He can be the funny, goofy guy, or he can be the serious wrestling machine inside the ropes. He's very versatile in that respect, and the time is right, because when you really look at the long-term picture, let's say John Cena gets beyond Ryback, as we all figure he will, whether it's Payback or whenever their last match is, and John Cena wins the feud. Who does John Cena feud with next? Who does he defend the WWE Championship against next? There's no logical next-in-line contender for him. I guess they can bring back CM Punk, but I feel like we've already seen Punk Cena a gazillion times, and you bring Punk back, I don't know that you put him right into a WWE Championship feud. So who is that person? There really is no obvious person that you put in that spot. Bryan would be a breath of fresh air in that position. And I think the dynamic of him and Cena face-to-face in the ring at, let's say, SummerSlam would be very interesting in terms of crowd reaction. You certainly would have a loud crowd, I think, no matter what, either way. Or you could do, again, Bryan and Ziggler. Bryan and Ziggler had some incredible matches together back in 2010 when they were feuding over the United States Championship, and now it's almost 3 years later. And as I say in the column, imagine how much better they are now. Imagine the kind of matches they could have together now for the world title. And you've got, in the corner of Dolph Ziggler, AJ Lee, who has her own history with Daniel Bryan. You could play off that. So there's a lot you can do. Ultimately, it's WWE's call what they want to do here, but the time is right. The time is right. You know, they're doing a good job with The Shield. They got a lot of guys down in NXT. And I'm going to talk about NXT this week because I actually watched this week's show, so I'll be doing a review for NXT. They've got a lot of really talented guys, but none of them are ready to be put in that position yet. They need somebody new, so to speak, in that position. Bryan would fit that bill. Not that he's brand new, but it would be new to see him in that position. And I think he would excel, and I think he would have the crowd behind him. And I think that's what needs to happen, and it needs to happen sooner rather than later. So check out the column on Layfield Report. What we're going to do here is talk a little bit about Extreme Rules. I know the show is a week old, so I'm not going to dwell on the results, but I've got some points to make that are still relevant that I think are worth mentioning here. I went 8-1 in my predictions, even though there really was no winner in the John Cena Ryback match. I did predict Ryback would win the title, and he didn't, so leave it to a John Cena match to screw me over. I'd have been batting 1,000 were it not for him. I thought Triple H and Brock had probably their best match to date. I mean, it was nothing outstanding, but it was certainly better than their WrestleMania match, definitely better than their SummerSlam match. The right guy won. You know, Brock wins the feud, gets to move on to CM Punk or whoever his next opponent is. Interesting note, he did cross Triple H's arms for the pin, the way that Undertaker does to his opponents. I don't know if that's a symbol of anything. The last we saw of Undertaker, he was taken out by the Shield. One would think that if Undertaker were to come back at some point later this year, he would do something with the Shield. And I think Undertaker is also supposed to be having some more surgery soon. I think on his shoulder, maybe his hip. But if he were able to wrestle at, let's say, SummerSlam this year, and that's a big if, but if he was, I'd be okay with doing Lesnar versus Undertaker there instead of WrestleMania. That way, you know, Undertaker can lose without having the streak broken, which gives Brock a big win heading into a possible match with The Rock at WrestleMania next year. I know that's the plan. I know Rock, I guess, has not made a decision yet one way or the other if he's going to wrestle again. I would be more than surprised if The Rock did not come back and wrestle again. So if I were a betting man, I'd say he is going to come back. He is going to have his match with Brock. And so you could do Taker-Lesnar at SummerSlam instead. And with Taker losing, it also plants some doubt as to whether, you know, has Undertaker's time come? Has his time come and gone heading into, let's say, a WrestleMania match against John Cena next year, which is the direction that I would go in. I think that's still the best opponent for The Undertaker. I like that idea a lot. But a lot of that will depend on, I guess, Undertaker's condition, if he's able to come back or not. I've heard nothing in that direction, but that's certainly one way they could go. The Cena-Ryback finish, I want to talk about that real quick here. That was a real cop-out. You know, doing a non-finish in the first match of a feud to set up the rematch is fine. We've seen that in wrestling for decades. The problem is, wrestling is ass backwards these days, and the first match between these two men was a last-man-standing match, a match that, by its very nature, tells you there will be a winner. Now, they did do a similar finish to what they did here with Rock and Mankind at the St. Valentine's Day Massacre pay-per-view back in 1999, which I actually happened to just watch again last week because it's on the new Best of In Your House DVD that WWE put out, which I finished and I highly recommend, by the way. It's a great, great DVD set. They did a deal in that match where Rock and Foley both smashed each other in the head with steel chairs at the exact same time. So after a match where they killed each other for 20 minutes with all sorts of weapons and just, you know, garbage cans and steel steps and everything else, and the month before that was the infamous I Quit match at the Royal Rumble, it took 15 chair shots to the head to put Mick Foley down. Here in this match, they hit each other in the head once with a chair, and both men sell it like they're dead. So the match ended in a draw, and guess what? The fans chanted bullshit, just like they did here with Cena and Ryback. And what made it worse was that after both guys fell through the staging last Sunday, the referee, he just stood there. He stood there with his jaw on the floor instead of counting like he was supposed to. And then we go behind the set, we see both guys laid out, Ryback is helped to his feet, and he just walks off. He didn't demand the title or ask the referee to start counting John Cena, he just walked away. So the finish was a real letdown. And, you know, Ryback had a legitimate case for being the champion after this, especially as a heel. You know, that would have been the first thing I expected out of his mouth on Raw the next night, and he never said a word. He just went right into promoting his ambulance match with Cena at the next pay-per-view. So I thought the ending of that match was a real letdown. They used the instant replay on this pay-per-view for the finish of the Del Rio Swagger match, which had a false finish with Swagger winning, and then the referee saw Zeb Coulter throw in Ricardo's towel, and it wasn't Ricardo himself doing it, so he ordered the match restarted and Del Rio won. For how many years have we heard there's no instant replay in WWE, the referee's decision is final? I mean, if they want to institute instant replay, that's cool. You know, I think that's fine. But they made no mention of it the next night. And you know the next time there's interference, this is all going to be ignored. So I think the whole thing was rather pointless. I guess they were just trying to go with a unique finish to the match. Maybe they were trying to make fun of the NFL or the NBA. I don't know. But I just thought that was kind of odd. Dean Ambrose, new United States champion. Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns are your new tag team champions. No real surprise there. Let's hope these guys help make the belts. And the stench of undercard sorrow doesn't rub off from those belts onto them. Randy Orton busted out the punt kick in his win over the Big Show, who is wrestling hurt, apparently with a shoulder injury, I believe. Sheamus beat Mark Henry in the lamest strap match you'll ever see. Not that the match didn't have any drama, but I expected people to be whipped like a government mule, as JR would say. And we saw more use of the strap by Mark Henry on Raw last week than we did at the pay-per-view. So after the match, Henry walked out backstage. He left the building. He said he was going home. And apparently he dinged his shoulder. He may be hurt. I don't know how seriously. But they should just bring him back as a babyface when he's ready to come back. Just bring him back as a babyface, being that he's been mostly booked like that anyway over the last 3 weeks. So hopefully that's what they have in mind for him. Chris Jericho over Fandango to keep that feud going. Miz over Cody Rhodes on the pre-show. Speaking of which, they brought back the pre-show for this pay-per-view, so it appears they are going to do this every month and not just save it for the big shows. I like it. I think they should do them more often. Again, it's an idea that I was talking about even a few years ago. I did a show once, episode 127 of The Sound Off. Basically, you know, the whole theme of the podcast was Vince McMahon is dead and I'm in charge. And it was a whole show of what I would do, you know, putting my money where my mouth is if I were in charge of WWE. And that was one of the things I talked about even then. Is having like a pregame and a postgame for these, at least the big pay-per-views, and make it feel more special and have these people playing the role almost of analysts. I mean, it's kind of weird, I guess, because again, we know it's not real, so it comes off as a little bit hokey, but I'm happy to see them doing it. They had Renee Young hosting along with Wade Barrett, Titus O'Neil, and Mick Foley. I saw a little bit of the pre-show. I saw none of the post-show, so I don't know how good or bad it was, but hopefully they'll do more of them. The only other point I want to make from the pay-per-view before we move on is something I've noticed in wrestling that bothers me, and it happened a lot on this show, and I know maybe I'm nitpicking, but just bear with me here. Caitlyn and Roman Reigns are two superstars on WWE's roster who both use the spear as their finish. Now, with Caitlyn, it may be less of an issue because they don't take the Divas division seriously. And really, how often do we see Caitlyn wrestle on TV? But still, they're getting it over as her finishing maneuver. And Roman Reigns has laid out top guys with his spear. I understand that Big Show was using the spear before either of them, although not really as his finish. Edge used it as a finish. Goldberg, back in the day, he used it as a setup move to the jackhammer. My point is, if you have people on the roster trying to get that move over as a finish, then Big Show and Ryback, and even John Cena on this show. John Cena stole a page from Roman Reigns, and he speared Ryback through the barricade at one point. These guys should not be using the spear as a meaningless setup move. And in the main event, Triple H used a figure four on Brock Lesnar. Of course, Brock Lesnar didn't submit. And meanwhile, you've got Ric Flair, who bestowed that move on Miz as his new finisher, and he's been beating guys with it, trying to get it over. He beat Cody Rhodes with it on this show. Did Triple H really have to use it in the cage? I mean, did he have to use the figure four? That's all I'm saying. They should make a conscious effort to stay away from stuff like that, because the other guys need all the help they can get to get their stuff over. That's all I'm saying. And I noticed it a lot on this pay-per-view. Raw was in Kansas City this past Monday night. Episode 1043. I've been tracking this ever since Raw 1000. Now I know every Raw episode number. I thought it was a pretty good show overall. We had some of the pros. We had angry, serious Daniel Bryan, who I referenced earlier, and an awesome, awesome six-man tag that, believe it or not, this match got over 22 minutes on Monday night. I think it went through like two or three commercial breaks. Just awesome stuff. We also had the former Michael McGillicuddy getting a new name and a new mouthpiece in Paul Heyman. He is the new Paul Heyman guy. And there were a lot of rumors during the day on Monday that, oh, maybe it's Rob Van Dam. You know, RVD's currently unsigned. He's a free agent. Maybe he'll come back and align with his former boss. And people were disappointed. Some people, anyway, that it wasn't RVD or a big name or anything like that. And you know what? It didn't bother me at all. I actually think it would have been something of a letdown if it was RVD. And the reason is this. Rob Van Dam has spent the last few years in TNA. He's been off television now for a few months. Last time we saw him, he was the X Division champion, defending the title against Kenny King. He lost the title to Kenny King and then disappeared shortly thereafter. And the reality is this. RVD was on Impact every single week. And I didn't give a shit about him on TV. And that may not even all be his fault. Maybe it's just the way he was booked. RVD became nothing special in TNA. He was on TV every single week. I didn't give a shit. Did you? Most people probably didn't. So all of a sudden, I'm supposed to care that he's on Raw like it's some big deal? I don't think so. So that didn't bother me at all. I like the idea that they decided to take a young guy. And I say young. I think he's like 33. He's not that young. But he's a young guy in the eyes of the fans in that, you know, he's been hanging around for so long now on NXT. Really hasn't gotten a shot yet. And they're giving an unknown commodity, essentially. I know that sounds weird because he's been with the company now for a few years. He's been on and off TV, but he really is still an unknown to the mass audience anyway. And they're taking a chance on the guy. They're not going with a main event guy who's already established, who doesn't need the rub. They're taking a guy who needs the help. And they're putting him with the one guy who, if Paul Heyman can't help get this guy over, then nobody can. There's no hope for him. Plus, they gave him some really badass remix Mr. Perfect theme music that just sounds really cool. So I'm sure you can find that somewhere on YouTube. The other part of the show that maybe was the best part of all, no John Cena. How about that? They did an injury angle with him at the pay-per-view, and they actually kept him off the show. Normally, their ADD would prevent them from doing so, but they actually did. They stuck to their guns. They kept him off the show. I'm sure he'll be back on TV this week. And again, I'm not saying that John Cena shouldn't be on Raw every week, but it was actually nice taking him off television. They should do that more often. Cena doesn't have to be on TV every single week. So that was actually one of the bright spots of the entire show, because I was convinced that this show was going to open up this week, and out comes John Cena with a big smile on his face, cutting comedy promos, and didn't happen. And that was actually quite refreshing. I want to talk about the Shield match a little bit here because, you know, in that match, and it goes to what I was saying earlier, I mean, everybody played their role perfectly in that match. It was over 20 minutes, great action, the fans were into it, the Shield got put over strong. I mean, everything about that match was perfect. But Daniel Bryan, this was the second time, I think, in as many weeks that he's been involved in one of these Shield six-mans, and he is the guy, even if just for 2 or 3 minutes, who really stood out. He gets in there, he gets the hot tag, he's a house of fire. The crowd is eating it up, everything he does, and it's just, it's amazing to see. Like I said earlier, it's amazing that even though he's been slotted in a certain position for so long, a position that is by no means a main event position, the people still treat him like, oh, they basically treat him like a top tier guy. So hopefully people are watching and they're listening and they get their act together and they push this man. There's also another great outing for the Shield. Like I said, I love the match. Give credit to Kane and you know, everybody, like I said, was great in that match. Some of the not-so-fun things about the show, we did not get the follow-up from Ryback that I thought we might as far as the Extreme Rules finish, claiming to be champion, arguing that he should be champion. He certainly has an argument to be made. Why he didn't make it, I don't know. But we also had Triple H on this show. Triple H was there to confront Paul Heyman and Curtis Axel. I forgot to mention that before. That is Michael McGillicuddy's new name. Curtis Axel, as Paul Heyman explained, it is a combination of Kurt Hennig, of course, his dad, Mr. Perfect, taking Kurt's name and combining it with Larry the Axe Hennig, who is Joe Hennig's grandfather, Mr. Perfect's dad. Why they wouldn't call him Curtis Axe or something, I don't know, but they went with the name Axel. So it's kind of a Rocky Maivia type situation. And I mean, look what happened with The Rock. Eventually, he dropped the whole Maivia thing, became The Rock. And who knows? Maybe one day Curtis Axel will just be called The Axe. Although perhaps Axe from Demolition may have something to say about that. Triple H came out, and he proceeded to treat Curtis Axel like a complete joke. He slapped him in the face, knocked him on his ass. Curtis Axel's response to this was to sit there with this dumb shit look on his face. He didn't get up and slap Triple H back or go after him. There wasn't a big brawl. He basically made Curtis Axel out to be a little bitch during this segment. And this was a question in the mailbag this week on SEScoops.com that I answered, because there was one very upset reader who wrote in and basically said, oh, did Triple H bury him and everything? And I'm not going to use the word bury again. That word is overused. I certainly would consider it suspect the way that he was treated in this segment. Here's a guy that needs all the help he can get in being looked upon as a legitimate threat, a guy who deserves to be now in the position that he's in. Triple H did him no favors in that segment. Now, it's just one segment, and supposedly Triple H behind the scenes has been very high on Joe Hennig for a long time. In fact, the only reason Joe Hennig is even in this spot now may well have to do with the fact that Triple H likes him. If that's the case, he certainly has a funny way of showing it on the air, but I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that they will do the right thing with him. They will push him. They will give him whatever support he needs. In the match, later on in the show, Triple H announced that he was going to have a match with Curtis Axel. And the match went maybe all of 5 or 6 minutes. And the finish of the match was Triple H was showing some ill effects of his battle with Brock Lesnar. He had been bashed in the head and the jaw, I guess, with a sledgehammer. And it was probably not a good thing for Triple H to be out there wrestling. He started... This reminded me of the angle they did with Shawn Michaels back in 1995, when Michaels came back too soon from post-concussion syndrome, and he was, you know, in a match with Owen Hart. He collapsed in the middle of the ring. That angle, actually, back in 95, was very, very well done. I bought into it initially. A lot of people bought into it. A lot of people in wrestling bought into that angle when it first happened, but it was all staged. This kind of reminded me of that. The only difference is maybe it's just times have changed. I'm sure not one person in the world over the age of 5 bought into what we were seeing. And, but you know what? Triple H tried. He was stumbling around, and the match just kind of ended. I don't even remember hearing a bell. I mean, they may have rang the bell, but I don't think any announcement was made, so I assume the match was just thrown away. I don't know that it was a win necessarily for Curtis Axel. The point is, the focus was not on Curtis Axel. The focus in the main event and at the end of the show when Raw went off the air was on Triple H. It was on whatever story they're trying to tell with Triple H. And Curtis Axel was, he was really just an afterthought. And I don't think that's the direction you want to go in with this guy, is making him out to be nothing more than an afterthought. So it's only 1 week. Let's see what they do this week. But certainly curious the way they treated this man on TV this week. Some other observations from the show. I cannot believe that Wade Barrett has new entrance music again. It's got to be some kind of record. I've lost track of how many songs this guy has had, how many variations of his theme music that he has had. He and Fandango teamed up against Chris Jericho and The Miz, and in the middle of their match, Fandango got on the mic, said his name, went outside, his music started playing, and he started dancing with Summer Rae. So Jericho nailed Barrett with the Codebreaker. Miz put him in the figure four. He tapped out. Again, not a good week to be the Intercontinental Champion, co-hosting the pre- and post-game show on the pay-per-view and then tapping out on Raw Monday night. And then came one of the more hilarious moments of the show. After the match, Miz and Jericho, they have Fandango cornered outside the ring in front of the announce desk. Jericho's coming around from one end, Miz from the other. And with nowhere to go, Fandango leaves Summer Rae, he ditches her, and he bails into the crowd. And in the process of running away, he steamrolled. The only way I could describe it, he just steamrolled over, shall we say, an overweight member of the WWE Universe. And I had to go back and watch this about 3 or 4 times because I'm a terrible human being, but it was indeed one of the more hilarious moments from Raw Monday night. Sheamus beat Titus O'Neil in a match that saw Titus drop a very audible F-bomb on a fan in the crowd. They did censor it. I'm sure he got an earful once he got backstage, and probably will think twice before he does that again, but Titus looked pretty good here, and, you know, even in defeat, it's very clear that of the two, between him and Darren Young, they see Titus as the potential breakout star in singles competition. JBL on commentary kept singing his praises. He was referring to him as a future world heavyweight champion. You know, he's got the size. He definitely has the personality and the charisma, so it's not that far-fetched to think that perhaps one day he could be a world champion. But let's not put the cart before the horse. He's got a ways to go as far as being perceived as a world title contender. Biggie Langston pinned Alberto Del Rio after AJ Lee threw Ricardo's bucket. I still have no idea what the purpose of this bucket is. I think at the we had a whole bunch of people gathered for Extreme Rules at Brian Blade's house last Sunday, and I don't remember if it was Noah or if it was Chad or who it was, but somebody made a comment about the bucket and that it's perhaps a tip bucket, which got a nice laugh because that's the only logical explanation I can come up with. Is he begging for change? What is the point of this bucket? Ever since Del Rio went babyface, you know, Ricardo has to carry this stupid bucket. I guess it's got confetti in it. I don't understand the point. But that got thrown into the ring. Referee was distracted. Langston gouged Del Rio's eyes, which set up for his ridiculous-looking finishing move. And he got the win, a big win for Big E over the number one contender to the World Heavyweight title. And, of course, you know the drill, even Steven. Del Rio got his win back on Main Event 2 days later. Speaking of AJ, she beat Layla with her octopus submission, clocked it at 1 minute 58 seconds on the old Diva stopwatch. I guess the new thing is that whenever AJ uses the octopus on her opponent, that person taps her ass repeatedly. I'm totally fine with that. For whatever reason, multiple times on this show, in fact, Michael Cole kept referring to Randy Orton as Randy Oton. Even JBL pointed this out and mocked him for it later on. Randy Oton. They had a backstage segment with Triple H getting ready for his match against Curtis Axel when Larry the Trainer came in and said the doctor doesn't think that Triple H can compete tonight. And the COO of this company responded by ignoring the doctor's advice and suggesting that if he didn't think Triple H should wrestle, or if he did anything to stop him from doing so, perhaps the doctor should start seeking employment elsewhere. I can envision the same conversation only with Triple H's drug test coming back and him telling the good doctor to make sure he loses it or start seeking employment elsewhere. Randy Orton won a fan poll that also included the likes of Great Khali and R-Truth as potential opponents for Jack Swagger. I'm very upset that when they do polls like this, especially this one, that they don't have a fourth option, none of the above. So those were some real great choices there, as you can tell. So Orton won. He and Swagger had a match that was almost as long as the Shield match. I don't know if it went 20 minutes, but if it didn't, it came pretty close. And it was fine. You know, I can't say it was a bad match. I was just bored for a good part of it. I think it was just that point in the show where you're closing in on 3 hours and you're not into it. You know, you just start losing interest or you start dozing off. It's too long. And I think this match, for me anyway, kind of fell victim to that. Main event was Triple H and Curtis Axel, which I talked about already. Triple H stumbling around on the outside at the end of the show looked the same way I did after my birthday 2 years ago. I think my night may have been worse. In fact, I'm sure it was. So that was Raw for Monday night. This Monday, coming up, is Bret Hart Appreciation Night in Calgary. They're going to be up in Canada. I believe Shawn Michaels will be there, among other special guests, I'm sure. However, I do not think any of this is airing on television. WWE has announced that after Raw goes off the air, they will be streaming all of the Bret Hart Appreciation Night segments live via their app. Oh yes, the WWE app. It's actually a very clever way to get people to download the app. I'll certainly be tuning in. If you do not already have the WWE app, my advice is if you want to watch this, download it now, because if you wait until Monday night and thousands of people go to download the app at once, well, you may run into some problems. NXT. Here's something I don't normally talk about on the show, largely just because I don't have the time, but I heard great things about this week's episode, and in particular that it was the debut of the former El Generico under his new moniker of Sami Zayn. This was his debut, and I said, well, I'm going to watch NXT this week, and I'm glad I did. Because it really was a good show. So let's just go through this here. Sami Zayn is El Generico's new name. As we all know, he is no longer wearing the mask. He has been demasked. A lot of people were very upset by this. And look, I like the El Generico character. If it were up to me, I think it's part of his personality. I would have kept him under the mask. I mean, there's always tweaks that you can do to the character. He could always lose the mask at some point. But to bring him in and just not even put the mask on him at first, you know, it upset a lot of people. But having said that, I watched him here, and I did see him in action, actually, at WrestleMania Access. We were in the stands watching some NXT matches, and he was in one. I don't remember who he wrestled. So it's not like I haven't seen him in this getup before. Lots of ole, ole, ole chants for Zayn. So these people at Full Sail were hip to who he was. It was a good match. And as far as his mannerisms, his moves and everything, he's basically Generico without the mask. You know, it's the same guy. It's not like they've had him change his whole repertoire, everything about the character, his moveset and everything else. It's Generico without the mask. So if you're a fan of his, you should really have no problem with this. He actually pulled off an awesome tornado DDT on Curt Hawkins for the win. So he got a win in his debut match. You can't really ask for anything more than that. So that was a fun way to start the show. We then got a Corey Graves promo video to hype his main event match against Bray Wyatt. Good way of giving us some background on the guy. Apparently he has sat in the tattoo parlor, the tattoo chair, for a total of 100 hours so far getting ink, which is 100 hours more than I will ever spend getting a tattoo. I said it on episode 253 when I did my predictions for 2013. Graves has a Jeff Hardy vibe to him. It's something about his look. And he's one of the three NXT stars I said to watch for this year as potentially being called up to the main roster. Ironically, the other two I mentioned on that episode also made appearances on this show. That being Bray Wyatt and Cassius Ohno. That's a little bit later on. We'll get to that. Antonio Cesaro popped up on this show, which is good because he wasn't even booked on Raw Monday night, so at least they found a spot for him on NXT. He made short work of Yoshitatsu, and then he cut the same promo he cut on Raw a few weeks back about how he puts the W in WWE, nobody can hold a candle to him. Sami Zayn came out to interrupt, so here we are with Claudio and Generico, to use their old ROH names. It's kind of cool to see the two of them jaw-jacking back and forth. Sami Zayn comes out, he challenges him to a match, and right here, right now, we have ourselves an Antonio Cesaro-Sami Zayn match. So Zayn pulling double duty on his first night in. The two went, I'd say they went maybe 5 or 6 minutes. Wasn't that long of a match, although again, Zayn had just wrestled, Antonio kind of wrestled. I mean, he basically just, he was in the ring with Yoshitatsu for maybe all of 45 seconds. So they went a few minutes. They had a very good back and forth match. Cesaro's power moves are so impressive to watch. You know, he did this weeks and weeks back on Raw, or maybe it was in their main event match against Kofi Kingston. He did this standing vertical suplex where he was standing on the inside of the ring on the second rope, and Kofi was on the outside on the apron, and he just lifted him up with ease into the air. It was just amazing to see. He did something similar in this match. I can't remember what the move was. But his power is just so impressive. Again, it boggles the mind how they can look at this guy and think he's too boring. But anyway, Zayn rolled him up for the pin. So two wins for the former El Generico in one night on this show. Not bad for his debut. Unfortunately for him, an angry Antonio Cesaro made him pay for it after the match. He laid him out with the Gotch neutralizer. And before the match, both guys were bantering back and forth on the microphone in different languages, and Sami Zayn was even speaking Arabic at one point. They mentioned his parents are actually of Syrian descent, which I did not know before this. And for this reason alone, knowing not just Arabic, but apparently he knows a whole bunch of different languages, for that reason alone, I could see them fast-tracking him to the main roster. You know, if you want to get into WWE and you want to get in their good graces, this is a good lesson for anybody who ever wants to go to WWE. Learn a whole bunch of different languages, because it is a global company. They are always traveling all over the world. They are always sending people off internationally to do publicity and whatnot. Trust me, it will work to your advantage if you know multiple languages. Renee Young was backstage. She interviewed Audrey Marie, the same Audrey Marie who was just cut by WWE last week. So, oops. I had another diva, Emma, show up to interrupt her, and I admit I have not been following NXT too closely of late, but just by going by this segment alone, I have no idea why they cut Audrey Marie. I thought she was pretty good, and Emma just came across as really dopey. I mean, maybe that's part of her character. I guess it is part of her character, but just her whole performance here, I just wasn't impressed by her at all. Maybe I just need to see more of her work. I'm sure all the Emma fans now will come out and eviscerate me. It could just be that I need to see more of her stuff, but of the two here, I was just left asking myself, why would they cut this girl and not the other one? We then got a Bray Wyatt video to complement the Corey Graves one we saw earlier. I love Bray Wyatt's character. It's just, he's thrown himself into it, you know what I mean? And he's just so, he's so good. He's so creepy. I still look at him with the white pants, and I can't help but think of Waylon Mercy, which, again, was one of those characters that, in a way, I guess it was kind of goofy, which was par for the course with WWE gimmicks back in 95, but there was something about that Waylon Mercy character that actually could have worked had he not been hurt and then had to retire. But I love the Bray Wyatt character. It's just, it's so different than anything else on WWE television right now, and again, he plays it to perfection. So I say call this man up already. Why is he floundering down here? Mason Ryan was back on my screen. Yes, that Mason Ryan, still looking gigantic. Not quite as gigantic as I remember him, but still very, very large. He's got the long hair and everything. He's really not much better in the ring than I remember him either. But in fairness, his match with Enzo Amore went maybe all of a minute. Did not really get to see a whole lot of Mason Ryan. Maybe he is better. Certainly didn't look it here. Enzo Amore, by the way, is someone Jim Ross said on Twitter several weeks back. Someone who has promise on the microphone is what JR said, if I remember correctly. And Amore did cut a promo on his way to the ring for the match, and he was okay. Now, everyone on NXT has promise, or else they wouldn't be there. But he didn't come across to me as anything special. He plays this Italian Jersey Guido type, which is just what we need more of. Next week, we were told Stephanie McMahon will appear on NXT to make a blockbuster announcement. I have no idea what that is, unless I suppose it could have something to do with the NXT Divas Tag Team belts. We saw them on display at WrestleMania Access. They had the display cases with all the championships, and as it was pointed out, there were NXT Divas Tag belts, and yet there is no NXT Divas Tag belts on TV. So perhaps that's going to be the announcement. I don't know. Just a guess. Also next week, there will be a battle royal to determine the number one contender to Big E Langston's NXT title. I know I believe the spoilers are out there as far as who that is. But we will find out. Those of us who actually want to watch NXT will find out next episode. Main event was Corey Graves against Bray Wyatt. Luke Harper and Eric Rowan were out there in Wyatt's corner. They are members of the Wyatt family. And are also the NXT Tag Team Champions. Wyatt was out there wearing the old Virgil protective face mask after Chris Jericho broke his nose in their match a few weeks ago at the NXT tapings. Both guys, Graves and Wyatt, really good in this match. Wyatt at one point used a standing crossbody on Graves, a very violent crossbody, I might add. I love that move. He used that same move as Husky Harris when he was part of the new Nexus. I love that move. When he does it, it's so violent and so sudden, it looks brutal. He won with a swinging reverse STO that he calls Sister Abigail, which is a move that is far too similar to Mr. Anderson's mic check, which, again, is not really a great move, in my opinion. I feel like that's just such a played-out move. You know, Cody Rhodes, for example, his move is different, but any sort of move like that where there's this like sudden downturn movement or whatever, I feel like we have a whole bunch of people using the same freaking move. I think, quite frankly, that Bray Wyatt could actually use that standing crossbody as his finisher. I think it looks great. Just like Antonio Cesaro's uppercut. That could be his finish, too. After the match, Harper and Rowan, they double-teamed Graves until Cassius Ohno ran out to make the save. I take it he's been a heel. And now he is going, or has gone, babyface. The numbers were, unfortunately for him, too much. He was laid out. And that was NXT. I was actually very impressed by NXT this week. Dare I say, I almost enjoyed it as much as Raw. I say almost because I thought Raw overall was a good show this week, although a lot of that had to do with the 20-minute Shield match. And the Shield still makes sporadic appearances on NXT. So when you really look at it like that, I don't know, maybe I do enjoy NXT than Raw. Maybe I do enjoy that more, I don't know. I will try to make more of an effort to watch the show, maybe not every single week, just because I just don't always have the time before I record the show, but I will certainly try to make time for it. One more observation about NXT here. William Regal has turned into a tremendous broadcaster. When he first started, I remember him being very timid, very soft-spoken voice, almost shy in a way. And he still speaks with a soft tongue, but he sounds much more confident. You know, he drops some good knowledge. He kind of the way JBL tends to do, even if half the stuff JBL says is complete fantasy. I still love it. And Regal just does the things that you would expect from an announcer. Tony Dawson, on the other hand, he's still learning. He may get better as time goes on. You know, the thing with Tony Dawson that I noticed on this show is that when he gets all excited and his voice raises, maybe before like a near fall or something, he doesn't sound genuine to me. It almost sounds like he's trying too hard to play the role of wrestling announcer. Like, if I was going to sit here and do my impression of Jim Ross calling a match, I don't claim that I would be any great shakes. It would probably sound like I'm doing a Jim Ross impersonation. That's kind of what Tony Dawson sounded like at different points of the show during some of these matches. He just has to find his own voice, and, you know, hopefully he does. Because, I mean, God knows, they don't have a very deep pool of talent when it comes to announcers down there. So hopefully he'll get better. But I just felt like on this show, he wasn't quite there. You know, but Regal, on the other hand, Regal should be on the main roster. Yeah, I don't know. You know, they have JBL now on Raw and SmackDown. Maybe they should share that duty. Maybe put Regal on SmackDown, keep JBL on Raw. It's just an idea. I want to talk about the Zema Ion situation with respect to TNA. For those of you who don't know, Zema Ion is a wrestler in the X Division on Impact, also an indie wrestler, real name Michael Paris. And he was rushed to the hospital. This would have been, was it last week or maybe the very end of the week prior to that? He was rushed to the hospital and diagnosed with appendicitis. So he had to have his appendix taken out. And while being examined for the appendicitis, his doctors discovered that there was a 5-centimeter tumor located on his colon. Now, they did a biopsy. They are waiting to determine whether or not the tumor is cancerous. But in any event, he's going to have to undergo a second surgery to get rid of the tumor, probably either way. So that's a very precarious position for anybody to be in, let alone somebody who's 26 years old. I'm sure it's a very frightening situation. I think cancer has probably touched the lives of a lot of people who listen to this show, whether it was you directly or a family member or a friend. It's no fun. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of uncertainty that goes into it. So I can sympathize with what he must be going through right now. And it's bad enough to have to worry about all of that. But on top of that, when you don't have insurance, as he does not, you have to worry about medical expenses. And his girlfriend started a GoFundMe campaign online, which is, you know, similar to this whole Kickstarter, Indiegogo stuff. Only with that, it's more for creative projects. This is just trying to raise money to help him pay his medical expenses. And probably only a fraction of what will be his medical expenses. The goal is $30,000. And last I checked, he was still under the $6,000 threshold. I can say that a donation has been made to him on behalf of the Sound Off. That happened this past week. And here's hoping TNA can do the same, or at least give enough once the end of this campaign comes to help meet the $30,000 goal that's been set. Let's say if he should fall short from fan donations only, which it looks like he might. On episode 156 of The Sound Off, I spoke at length about TNA's appalling treatment of the Knockouts after an expose that was done on the Cage Side Seats website. It was mostly regarding the Daphne situation. For those of you who are not familiar with that story, it'll make you extremely angry. You can find it online. There's actually been a ton written about it. The whole Daphne thing actually was only recently settled between her and TNA, I think only just a few months ago. Among the things that she was doing, Daphne was challenging the independent contractor status for wrestlers, which is an issue not just with TNA, but with WWE. You know, neither company considers their performers to be employees. They're independent contractors, and there was a lawsuit way back when brought against WWE by Raven, Mike Sanders, which is a name from the dying days of WCW, and I think there was a third person challenging the independent contractor status that was unsuccessful. And so in this case, Daphne, what Daphne really was doing, and again, you'll read the story about it and it'll just make you furious. Daphne had sustained several serious injuries during her time in TNA, including a stunt at one of the pay-per-views that involved her being put through, a barbed wire board that was set up outside the ring. I think Abyss chokeslammed her through it, and she claimed she was very hesitant to do the spot, and she was told, don't worry about it. And of course, she suffered a very serious concussion on that spot. I think she suffered a broken arm as well. There was a separate incident where she was in the ring with a female student from the Team 3D Wrestling Academy who was very reckless and sat, just this heavyset woman just sat down on Daphne, and she sustained a very serious sternum injury, all of these different injuries, and back and forth dialogue with her and Terry Taylor, who worked, I think, in talent relations at the time for TNA, and claimed that, you know, that would be taken care of as far as her medical expenses, and then they backtracked, and it certainly looked as though TNA went out of its way not to pay for Daphne's medical expenses, and in the end it bit them on the ass, and they had to settle with her, because the one thing TNA, and interestingly enough, WWE, did not want was for this case to go to a judge who would rule and say, you know what, it isn't right that these wrestlers are deemed independent contractors. Believe me, I'm sure that was a case that Vince McMahon and WWE lawyers were following very closely, and I don't know if maybe even they had something to do with convincing TNA to go ahead and settle, or if TNA just saw the writing on the wall and decided to settle on their own. It wouldn't surprise me if it ever came out that WWE perhaps put a word in to Dixie and said, listen, you better settle this stuff right now. But in any event, that was a huge black eye on the company. It really was. And so now we have a situation that's it's very different, but one of its performers is in a state of distress. He's got mounting medical expenses. And it's a situation where TNA can really make good and do the right thing. Now, are they obligated to? No, they're not. TNA does not offer health insurance to its wrestlers. Neither does WWE. WWE urges its wrestlers to get their own insurance, although they will cover the costs of injuries that are sustained on their watch in the ring. I don't think that's ever been an issue. If you've worked for WWE, I've never heard of it being an issue before. That stuff just gets taken care of. And Zema Ion does take independent bookings. He does not wrestle exclusively for TNA. But you know what? He's still under contract to TNA. And he sure isn't allowed to go wrestle for WWE if he wanted to. He can't just go ahead and do that. So he is bound by this contract that does have certain restrictions to it. TNA should do the right thing here, and they should help him in some way, shape, or form. And is it possible they've already helped him? Maybe they have. Maybe they have, and we're just not aware of it. It hasn't come out. But, you know, his girlfriend is still running this campaign, collecting donations from other people, and there's been no indication that TNA has done anything. I know other people have reached out to TNA. People are tweeting Dixie Carter on Twitter, and she has not said word one about this. And you would think that if TNA was doing something to help this kid out, that they would have said something to shut all these people up, and they've said nothing. And on Impact Thursday night, the only mention of any of this was a passing mention on commentary that Zema Ion had recently had his appendix out and he would be out of action for a while. That's it. It's a little more serious than that, but you'd never know that if you watched Impact on Thursday. You'd think, hey, this guy's got a boo-boo, he'll get it fixed and he'll be back soon. No mention of the fundraiser that his girlfriend is running or how fans can help or can donate. You know why? Because they know how it would make them look if they had to promote a fan-supported fundraiser online to help this kid pay his medical bills, because TNA wouldn't. It just makes them look so Bush League. And it's funny to me that you have this company here that seems so desperate to not be perceived as second-rate or Bush League as compared, you know, for example, to WWE. And they do it to themselves just by virtue of their own behavior, the things they do, the things they don't do. It just makes them look so Bush League. So hopefully TNA will do the right thing here and will help this kid out in some way, shape, or form. And if they do, I'll be the first one to report it right here on the Sound Off. And if they don't, then you can bet your ass this isn't the last that you're going to hear of this story. Impact from Thursday night. Hulk Hogan and Sting opened up the show, naturally. Brooke Hogan eventually came out, got all emotional, telling her father that she blamed herself for coming between Hulk and Sting and causing all of this trouble with Bully, and she said that as such, she would be resigning as the head of the Knockouts division. My question is, what does one have to do with the other? What does running the Knockouts division have to do with what's going on with Bully and Hulk and Sting. Hulk was probably thinking the same thing because he was trying to talk his daughter out of it. And I don't know if he ever did or not. There was never any indication one way or the other if Brooke had in fact resigned as the head of the Divas division. Or the Knockouts, I should say. I don't think Brooke officially resigned, but really, who cares? Bully Ray came out. He was a great heel, telling Brooke he still loves her. He will always love her. Never take his ring off. The way that Brooke was behaving here, they wanted you to think that she was going to turn on Sting and her father at some point and join her husband in Aces and Eights. And if that wasn't what they wanted us to think, well, then this was an epic fail. But I'm pretty sure that was the idea here. Suicide made his first appearance on Impact since 2011. He beat Joey Ryan and Petey Williams in an X Division three-way. Kenny King was on commentary at ringside. The way that he was moving around in there, I thought for sure that Suicide was being played by Low-Ki, the former Senshi in TNA. But apparently it was former Ring of Honor star TJ Perkins under the mask. He looked really good out there. Suicide was great in this match. Just completely flawless, smooth. I mean, just really, really good stuff. Very impressed. And he got the win with the pin on Joey Ryan. It was supposed to be Sam Shaw against Alex Silva in this week's Battle of the Past Gut Check winners, but Silva no-showed. Aces and Eights came out, said they attacked him in the parking lot. Apparently he wasn't even really there. He was stuck in traffic somewhere. There was some sort of travel issue, and he just didn't make it in time. So we never did get to see the beatdown. Wes Briscoe got to cut a promo on Sam Shaw, which really wasn't all that good, to be honest with you. Aces and Eights beat down Sam Shaw until Magnus came out to make the save, and then he challenged Briscoe to a match, which Magnus won by DQ after Aces and Eights ran in. Samoa Joe made the save for Magnus. What happened to Sam Shaw in all of this? I have no idea. Jay Bradley was supposed to meet the winner of that match at Slammiversary to see who advanced to the Bound for Glory series. But they did a poor job of explaining where things now stand. So, and by poor job, I mean they made no attempt at all to explain what happens now. Magnus looked good, though. You know, Magnus is a breakout star waiting to happen. I talk about Daniel Bryan being a breakout star in WWE. Magnus could be that guy in TNA. In as much as anybody can truly break out in TNA, he could be that guy. Bobby Roode and Austin Aries, I guess, did. But, you know, they're back to working tag team matches. So really, how much did they break out? Mr. Anderson pinned Kurt Angle after AJ Styles came out and gave the impression that he had joined Aces and Eights, which of course was just one giant swerve, and Kurt Angle was dumb enough to fall for it. He got low blowed and rolled up for the win. We learned that TNA will be announcing its second inductee into the TNA Hall of Fame at Slammiversary. There really is only one name that it should be. That, of course, is Jeff Jarrett. Hopefully he gets the nod. They had a segment to set up the tag team match at Slammiversary, which is going to be a four-way. It'll be Chavo and Hernandez defending the tag team titles against Aries and Rude, against the team of Bad Influence, Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian, and James Storm and a mystery partner. And so James Storm came out. He was about to announce who the mystery partner was. And instead we had Shark Boy make an appearance on this show. We haven't seen Shark Boy, according to, I think, Mike Tenay, since 2011, much like Suicide. He has not appeared on TNA television, although he was unmasked, actually, in Nigel McGuinness's documentary. So if you ever wonder what Shark Boy looks like unmasked, I'm too lazy to go search and see if there are any photos of him readily available unmasked. But if you're curious, you can check out Nigel's documentary for that. He came down, did some comedy in the ring, you know, he said, give me a shell, yeah, and all that stuff. And Steve Austin, by the way, on Twitter, who was watching Impact this week, said he has no problem with Shark Boy making a living, so it's not like he's upset by him stealing his gimmick. Robbie E came out, he did some really bad comedy, he and Shark Boy went back and forth, and all of a sudden, out of the crowd comes Gunner. Gunner is somebody who, you know, looks like your average generic pro wrestler. He's got a nice body. He's got the goatee or whatever. I didn't recognize who the hell he was at first. And part of the problem is Gunner's been off TV for a long time. I don't know where he's been. I think he may have been down at OVW. I can't remember the last time Gunner was on TV. So the crowd reacted the same way that I did. It was almost like they didn't know who he was. And he stood face to face with James Storm. He ended up taking out both Shark Boy and Robbie E, which I guess impressed James Storm, and James Storm said, you're my tag team partner, so it's going to be James Storm and Gunner, and I wonder how much James Storm is actually going to do in that match because while the diagnosis of his injury was actually good news, it's not as serious as originally feared. It's a partial tear. There's no hernia. He still has to be out of action for 6 to 8 weeks, which means he really should not be wrestling at Slammiversary. So my guess is the format of the match allows for him to be protected. I don't know that he'll see very much ring time at all. It'll probably be Gunnar doing most of the work. Maybe they do an angle on TV before the pay-per-view to take Storm out of the match. I don't know, but he should not be wrestling. They had a backstage segment that was just great. Joseph Park was with Sting in the locker room, and it's going to be Joseph Park and D-Von for the television title at Slammiversary. And Park was telling Sting that some of the boys were talking about him getting the strap. And he said, that sounds painful. And Sting had to smarten him up and tell him that they were actually referring to the championship, not that they were going to whip him with a strap. And I just love the Joe Park character. When they do segments like this, I just think he's great. I can watch this all day. And Sting basically said, next week, D-Von and Bully Ray are going to face Sting and a partner of his choosing in a tag team match. And Sting said he really wants Joe Park's brother, Abyss, to be his partner. And Joe Park said that he couldn't help him. He doesn't know where Abyss is. Abyss won't even talk to him. And Sting said something about, you know, Joe Park kayfabbing him. Basically, Sting seems to be the only person in the world on that roster who pretty much knows that Joe Park and Abyss are now one and the same, always have been. And instead, Sting said, okay, Joe, you can be my tag team partner. So it'll be Joseph Park and Sting next week against the Dudley Boys in tag team action. Mickie James had a Knockouts title match against Velvet Sky, beat Velvet Sky, and Mickie James is the new Knockouts champion. They had a match. There was a point in this match, I don't know what the hell happened. They were doing some moves, and Velvet Sky had her back turned to Mickie James. Mickie James, I think, kicked her. She was trying to do something, and Velvet just stood there. She didn't move. She looked like she was paralyzed in place. Maybe she forgot what she was supposed to do, but she just froze. She didn't move. It looked terrible. It looked, I mean, every word you could think of, it looked amateur. She looked awful in this match, did Velvet Sky, and Mickie James did what she could. The right person certainly won, I will say that, and Mickie James is your champion now. They did a segment earlier in the show to kind of set this whole angle up where Velvet Sky's been nursing a knee injury for several weeks, and Mickie was like, listen, are you sure you want to have this match? Because we could delay it. I can go to Brooke Hogan and try to get the match postponed, and Velvet, being the valiant babyface champion, said, no, we're going to have a match tonight. I'm good. I'll be okay. And it played into the finish because Mickie James went after the knee of Velvet Sky, and that's kind of how she ended up beating her. So I don't know that we can necessarily say Mickie James turned heel, although I think that's the direction they're going in. I mean, realistically, Mickie James, she didn't do anything wrong. You're in the ring with your opponent. She gave Velvet Sky the chance to bail out and delay the match by 1 week. Velvet Sky said no. She went after the knee. I'd go after the knee. Are you kidding me? I'd do the exact same thing she did. So I won't call it a heel turn, but she certainly did not endear herself to Velvet Sky, and perhaps their friendship now is over. I don't know. But Mickie James is the new champion for the first time, I think they said, in 2 years. So congratulations to her. End of the show was the culmination of a show-long storyline where Aces and Eights was going to initiate AJ Styles into the family. They were going to give him his cut, his vest. AJ had been teasing that he had indeed joined Aces and Eights. AJ came out. They had this whole big pomp and circumstance deal going on in the ring. And Kurt Angle came out. And Kurt Angle, of course, is challenging AJ Styles to a match at Slammiversary. Angle was attacked by the Aces and Eights. They were holding him. They gave AJ Styles a hammer. And AJ Styles bashed Kurt Angle in the knee with a hammer. So he left Kurt Angle laying with a hammer shot. All the Aces and Eights then did their little pose. And at that point, the jig was finally up. AJ Styles used the hammer to hit Doc. He actually hit a whole bunch of people. And the thing is, when he hit Doc with the hammer, he hit him right in the face. And so, in theory, he basically killed Doc. And this is the stuff that I hate with this Aces and Eights shit. is that when they use the hammer, they use the hammer so liberally, they just very casually bash people in the back of the head, they bash them in the gut, they bash them in the knee with a hammer. A hammer! And it's like, it has no effect. The person's back the next week. Oh, you know, you put a little bit of a wrap on it, you'll be fine. He hit the guy in the face. And the announcers don't even sell it like it's a big deal. It's like he hit him in the face with a chair, you know, or any other normal inanimate wrestling object. It was a freaking hammer, for crying out loud. That whole Aces and Eights thing, it's just so stupid. So dumb. But anyway, AJ Styles, you know, anybody could have seen this coming from a mile away. He didn't join Aces and Eights. He hit Kurt with the hammer, and he hit the Aces and Eights guys with a hammer to prove, I guess, that he is a man all by himself. He is not part of TNA. He is not part of Aces and Eights. He is part of his own little clique in his own mind. He does his own thing, and that's, you know, AJ Styles is Sting 2013. He's basically playing the role of Sting from 1997, which we already knew. But they drag this thing out so much that, you know, by the end, and here's the thing, they did the turn finally. They revealed that AJ was not with Aces and Eights, and they went off the air like not even 10 seconds later. They didn't even give you time to really just kind of take in what you just saw. They just kind of faded out, and that was it. They went right into the next show. So when they do stuff like that, it doesn't have the intended effect. You got to let people process what they just saw. They didn't really give you a chance to do that. And the hammer shit just pisses me off. It's just so stupid. It's so dopey. I can't take these buffoons seriously. So that was a lame way for Impact to go off the air. Not a bad show, but just, I don't know, left a bad taste in my mouth. Move on to the mailbag. If you have questions to send in to me, email them to thesolomonster@gmail.com. I actually got an email this week from one of our listeners, Rob Francois, who wrote in to point out something very interesting about the date of May 27th. Now, as I record this, tomorrow is May 27th. It is the Memorial Day holiday here in the United States. And perhaps there was no more historically important event that has taken place in wrestling history on the date of May 27th than what happened 17 years ago on the 27th this week, 1996, was the night that Scott Hall first showed up on WCW Monday Nitro unannounced. It was the unofficial kickoff of the NWO Invasion storyline. Scott Hall showed up that week. He showed up the following week. Before long, he brought in Kevin Nash. They were the Outsiders, this invading force from up north. And then, of course, Hogan turned heel, joined the NWO. And after that, it was off to the races. So a very historically important date in wrestling history. And part of the reason I also bring this up is this week in Dave Meltzer's Wrestling Observer newsletter, he had a tremendous write-up on the kind of the dying days of WCW and ECW and a lot of the things and the maneuvering that was going on at the last minute to try to keep both of those promotions afloat. And also just what might have been, you know, had this not happened, had this been changed, had this person come on board, how things perhaps could have been differently. It's a fascinating article. It's a great read. I would encourage everybody to sign up just to read that piece. That's how good it is. But, you know, one thing I've always been curious about, I didn't really give it much thought until after I read Meltzer's piece, and this is not something he talked about in his article. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen anybody write about this, is one of the central figures in the dying days of WCW, essentially in the death of WCW, was a Turner executive by the name of Jamie Kellner. Jamie Kellner, I believe, had just been appointed at that time to oversee all of the Turner networks, and that included TBS and TNT, which, of course, aired WCW programming. So Jamie Kellner comes in, and he's not a big fan of wrestling, and he was looking to take those networks in a different direction, wanted nothing to do with wrestling on those channels, and so he essentially canceled WCW. Now, Eric Bischoff had been making a play to buy WCW, start the investors on board, and in fact, in January of 2001, 2 months before the sale of WCW to Vince McMahon, there was a press conference to announce that, in fact, Eric Bischoff had bought WCW. They actually did the press conference before the contracts were even signed. It was formally announced that Eric Bischoff was buying WCW. That announcement actually happened. In the end, of course, things went south. It didn't happen. Vince swooped in, bought the remains of WCW for $2.5 million. He got the tape library, he got the copyrights, the trademarks, a whole bunch of other stuff, some talent contracts he picked up as well for a lot of the mid-card guys. But Bischoff was banking on those TV time slots to really relaunch WCW, and once Jamie Kellner came in and basically canceled the Nitro slot and the Thunder slot, that was it. You know, Bischoff saw the writing on the wall and he realized that without TV, that's it. This company is worthless. I can't do what I want to do without TV. And so there was some other discussions with other networks. Bischoff was in talks with FX. He was hopeful perhaps something would happen with FX, but time just ran out. And unfortunately for him, that did not happen. One thing I've always wondered is what the hell happened to Jamie Kellner? And again, you know, Meltzer, nobody talks about this. And so, you know, I looked it up. You know, I thought, was he still working for Turner? Is he still, has he been promoted? You know, is he in an even higher position than he was back in 2001 when this all went down? Did he retire? What happened to the guy? So I looked it up, and if you can believe it, Jamie Kellner left Turner Broadcasting. Again, he was basically the chairman and CEO of TBS, and he left his post in 2003. 2 years later, Phil Kent was brought in to replace him. I have no idea if Phil Kent is a wrestling fan or what, whatever, but he was on the job for 2 years, and he left, and he went to go work somewhere else. I think he actually left to go become the CEO of the WB network. And Jamie Kellner actually has his own Wikipedia page as well. And apparently he was going canceling crazy because he canceled a whole bunch of cartoons on the WB that had been very successful. Pinky and the Brain, Animaniacs, Superman the Animated Series. He just went and canceled all of them. So this guy seems like a real charmer. But 2 years. He was on the job for 2 years, and then he left. So it's already been a decade since Jamie Kellner was at the helm over at Turner Broadcasting, and it just makes you scratch your head and wonder, God, you know, had circumstances been just a little bit different, either he wasn't brought in, or maybe he was brought in years earlier and he resigned just as all of this was going down, and somebody else was brought in to replace him, perhaps somebody who was a wrestling fan or had a respect for the product. How different things might have been if those time slots were preserved. You know, as far as what would have happened with Bischoff and his investors, you know, a lot was going on back then. Paul Heyman was feverishly looking for somebody to help him. I mean, in the new Barbed Wire City documentary about the ECW, the original ECW promotion, there's a great story from Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins. Billy Corgan is a great wrestling fan, was a big ECW fan back in the day, and he tells the story of Paul Heyman coming to him and saying, listen, I need money to help keep this thing going. And Billy Corgan says, well, how much do you need? And he says, I need $1 million, and I'll give you 10% of the company. And Billy Corgan wasn't a dumb guy. He said, it's not worth $1 million. And he didn't do it. Heyman thought he was going to be able to get on USA Network after, you know, TNN had basically screwed him over in his mind. He supposedly had meetings with somebody at USA Network about the possibility of bringing ECW to the channel. This was when WWE was making the jump over to what would later become Spike TV. At the time, it was the new TNN. And there was just a lot of moving parts at the time, and it's perhaps the biggest what-if in the history of professional wrestling. What would have happened if these circumstances were different and Jamie Kellner, you know, 2 years is not a long time to spend in one place, and to think he came in, he pulled the plug on wrestling, and then 2 years later, he was gone, and somebody else was in his place. And meanwhile, the effects of that decision are still felt even to this day. The wrestling business is far worse for there not being any competition to Vince McMahon and WWE. And the thing is, you know, Vince could have bought WCW and ECW together at the same time if he wanted to. I mean, hell, he was already bankrolling ECW its last few years. He was giving a check to Paul Heyman every week. And Vince wasn't a dumb guy. It's not like Vince McMahon had this great respect for the ECW product and everything. You know, Vince knew that when push comes to shove and ECW goes belly up, you know, he'll be listed as a creditor and he can, you know, and he did. You know, he got the assets to ECW. He got the ECW logo, the tape library, and everything else. He was very shrewd and very smart in that respect. But, you know, if I were in control, it's easy for me to say, if I were in control at the time, and let's say Jamie Kellner was not in charge at the time and kept the slots on TNT and or TBS for wrestling, I would envision, if I'm, let's say, Vince McMahon and I scoop up both of these promotions, I would envision running WCW as a separate entity on the Turner networks and either keep Raw on USA and run ECW as a separate brand, let's say on UPN, which was broadcasting SmackDown on network television, or maybe vice versa, since ECW would probably have less leeway on network television than they would on cable. And SmackDown on Thursdays would often outdraw Raw back then. So WWE actually would have more eyeballs for its own stars on Thursday nights. Maybe you give them Thursday nights and give ECW Mondays. And in theory, come to think of it, if you have WWE on one night on Thursdays, that might actually boost interest in the product because now you're only running one show per week instead of two, which means to see those stars, people would have no choice but to tune in on Thursdays. So again, this is all, you know, pie in the sky, what if, but certainly I think that that would be a move that I would want to make if I were in control of the time. And there were a lot of issues as far as why some of this stuff didn't happen. Vince wanted to. He wanted to maintain WCW on Turner. He would have loved to do that, but based on the contract that they had at the time with again, what would become Spike TV, they weren't allowed. You know, Spike was the exclusive cable home for WWE. It didn't matter if it was technically another promotion or anything like that, so it didn't work out. It's a fascinating read, and I was even more fascinated when I looked it up and found out that Jamie Kellner was only briefly in the position of power over there, and you know, you can't say Jamie Kellner is the reason WCW died. That's just way too, it's way too easy to simplify it that way. He was certainly a part of it. He certainly played a role in the ultimate demise of WCW. And it's, like I said, one of the biggest what-ifs, I think, in the history of wrestling. What if he was gone by that time? What if he was never in that position of power in the first place, and you had somebody like, you know, Ted Turner back in the day? Ted Turner had an affinity in his heart for wrestling because, you know, wrestling was what really what put TBS on the map back in the day. If you go back to the early 80s, Turner always had a soft spot for wrestling. What if somebody else came along and was put in charge of those networks, and they too were a wrestling fan, and they had a soft spot for wrestling? Robert Brunning from London, England writes in last week's mailbag, you answered a question from Simon Penny regarding CM Punk being a cog in the wheel of the WWE machine. This got me thinking, and I have to ask myself the question, how good is CM Punk? Having attended WrestleMania 24 and 25, I was, to be frank, unimpressed with CM Punk winning Money in the Bank 2 years in a row. I can't help but think how the careers of talents like John Morrison, MVP, or Shelton Benjamin could have benefited from such a win. Is CM Punk's position on the card propping up the cash cow John Cena really warranted, or was it to the detriment of other superstars who I believe could have gone on to have better careers in the main event picture? I'm not really a fan of the same person winning anything 2 years in a row, whether it's Money in the Bank or the Royal Rumble or whatever. So, you know, yeah, MVP or Morrison could have won the second time out, but if they didn't have plans to put the world title on either one of those guys, then what's the point? You know, they obviously had some idea of where they were going with CM Punk at that time, although I don't think even then WWE ever expected him to become a major star like he has in recent years. But if to them MVP and Morrison and these guys were slotted in the mid-card, then why the hell are you going to have them win Money in the Bank? They obviously didn't see those guys on that level, or else they would have gotten there at some point. MVP, he improved a lot later on. So him winning would have been, you know, it would have been disappointing at that time because at that time MVP wasn't as big of a star as he would go on to become. And if, I mean, look, working with guys like Chris Benoit every week and stuff, you're going to improve. You're going to get better. And then, of course, later on, he went to Japan and got even better. But as for the idea that Punk's elevation wasn't warranted and somehow his push may have prevented other guys from getting a main event push, I could not disagree more. If anything, you could argue that because of CM Punk breaking through and getting over the way he did in 2011, that it benefited guys like Daniel Bryan and The Shield, because that was what really opened up some eyes in WWE, not just about Punk, but a lot of these guys that came from the indies. And now they're signing up a whole bunch more down in developmental. They've got Ono and Neville and Sami Callihan just signed. 3 or 4 years ago, I doubt very seriously they would have even given those guys a second look. So if anything, I think CM Punk deserves a lot of credit for the opportunities that some of these guys are getting now. It's not a question of him holding back somebody else like some other mid-card guy or guy from the independent scene would have been in the position Punk is in, were he not taking up a spot. I think that's a completely flawed way of looking at it. I completely disagree. Shads writes in, he wants to know my thoughts on reviving the Nation of Domination. He says, when or if Mark Henry returns, he could return as the leader along with the primetime players in a new Kofi Kingston haircut, suit, and all. Hey, that's my idea. I wouldn't want Otunga in there, but you could throw him in there as well as the mouthpiece. This could be very effective if done right. I am not a fan of reviving dead factions. I guess under the right circumstances, it could happen. Bringing back the Nation, you know, the whole point of the Nation when it was first started, it was playing off racial tensions. And I don't see the need for a racial angle in WWE, but if you wanted to go in that direction, what's the argument? You're saying Mark Henry. Now, Mark Henry has an argument as far as being bullied by Sheamus. I don't know where race plays into that. But look at, you know, the primetime players. I guess they could say they've been held back. Kofi Kingston's been doing very well for himself. He was a tag team champion. He had a run as the United States champion. You know, all of a sudden, Kofi Kingston he thinks WWE hates him because he's black. I don't get it. You know, when I think of the Nation, maybe not the later incarnation, but certainly when it was started by Farouk back in the day, there was a racial element to it. And unless you're going to bring that aspect back, why even bother bringing back the Nation? Why do we have to have a group full of guys that look a certain way? I don't really think that's such a great idea. The second part of Shad's question, though, he also says, WrestleMania 13 is his all-time favorite WrestleMania. He says, specifically, when you look back at how significant it was for the careers of The Rock, Stone Cold, Bret Hart, Undertaker, Triple H, and even Ken Shamrock. Looking back on it now, where would you place WrestleMania 13 among your favorite manias? Well, help me out here because I don't really follow you. Obviously, WrestleMania 13 had a tremendous impact on the career of Steve Austin. I don't think anybody would debate that. Bret Hart had a great match at WrestleMania that year. I would hardly say that it was significant for his career. Undertaker won the championship. I guess that's kind of a big deal. But long term, did that really have any major effect on his career? It was just another match. You know, he beat Sid Justice. Psycho Sid, whatever his name is. He's got so many names. Sid Vicious, Sid Justice, Psycho Sid. But yeah, I mean, Undertaker, it's not really a big deal. Ken Shamrock was a referee for a match. I don't really think that had much of an effect on his career. You say The Rock. The Rock was in a meaningless undercard match as Rocky Maivia against the Sultan for the Intercontinental title. I don't really see how WrestleMania 13 had any sort of positive effect on The Rock's career. So, Stone Cold, yes. Everybody else, no. And I'm glad you enjoyed WrestleMania 13, to each their own. But to me, WrestleMania 13 will go down as one of the worst WrestleMania shows of all time. And that includes the Bret Austin match. Made that show. It was great. One of the all-time great matches. But overall, as a WrestleMania, yeah, that's towards the bottom of the barrel. Want to give a quick shout-out to Trayvon Clark, one of our listeners. He recently underwent a kidney transplant and said that listening to the sound off during his time in dialysis helped him pass the time and keep his sanity. So, to Trayvon, happy birthday, my friend. Glad I could help. And get well very soon. If you have questions for the mailbag, email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. I read everything that you guys send me and try to get as much on the air as I can. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. As always, that is the handle. You can friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolomonster. Send me a friend request. I will approve you. We have great debate and discussion going on each and every Monday night during Raw and the pay-per-view shows as well. And for those who aren't aware, we actually have we have three things. We have the profile page. We have a Solomonster Sounds Off fan page that you can like on Facebook. And there's also a group. It is a closed group. You have to apply for membership. It's a discussion group on Facebook, so if you want to look for it, send a request. I will be sure to get you in there as well. You can subscribe to The Sound Off in iTunes. Type in the name of the show. It will come right up, and every time a new episode is uploaded, it will be automatically downloaded for you. You can download there's a bazillion different ways you can get the show. There's an Android app dedicated to the show. We are on Stitcher, Radio On Demand. If you want to download the Stitcher Radio app or listen to us on your desktop through Stitcher, you can do that as well. And, of course, check me out on LayfieldReport.com. I have at least one new column that goes up every week. The new one on Daniel Bryan is up right now. The more people who read it, open it, share it, retweet it is very helpful to me, so please go ahead and do that. And that wraps up things for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening. I very much appreciate your support. Everybody who filled out the Solomonster Sounds Off survey as well. Thank you very much for your feedback. I'm not even halfway through all the feedback yet. I'm really learning a lot going through it. It's been very valuable to me, so I thank everybody who applied. That survey will probably be shut off very soon, so I'm not gonna plug it. You can still fill out the survey if you have not yet done so. You can find a link somewhere on my Twitter, but I just wanted to say thank you to everybody who took the time to fill that out. We'll be back here for episode 276 next weekend on SEScoops.com, Stitcher, and everything else. So until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you again, and we will see you right back here next week. Take care, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.